Welcome, Tom Greco.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Thanks for that warm welcome. Well, I'm really glad to be back in Sebastopol. I've been here a few times before, and Phil and I and Art and Ed and a number of other people have been working on this project for a long time. And I'm happy to be able to provide whatever assistance I can in seeing this project through. We thought it would be launched by now, but things take whatever time they take. The biggest problem, I think, in developing a community exchange system is in developing, first of all, the best architecture for the system that's possible. And we don't have a lot of good models. You know, we're at the stage of development with alternative exchange that aviation was at more than 100 years ago. So you've seen all the pictures of the umbrellas bouncing up and down, people flapping their wings and jumping off roofs, trying to fly. And so we've had a lot of false starts and experiments that didn't work out too well. But there are some promising things as well. And we have a lot of good information from the past. I've benefited from the research that I've done in discovering some really insightful people from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, people who really understood money. And I think if we're going to come to some really effective alternative exchange systems, we're going to have to take a scientific approach to it. Flying by the seat of the pants will only get you so far. What made the Wright brothers so successful in their attempts to achieve manned powered flight was the fact that they did take a scientific approach and they did a lot of experimentation. They learned what they could from people who had gone before, and they designed the first wind tunnels and they did a lot of accurate measurements from their experiments. And there were three basic problems they had. One was lift. How do you get lift with a craft that's heavier than air? Another one was propulsion. How do you get the thing to move? And the third one was control. How do you control it once you get it up there so you don't crash? So we have a similar situation with the alternative exchange movement. We've got to find the answers that are analogous to those three factors. Well, let me start with a PowerPoint slideshow that I think will be useful. So Phil was talking about localization, and I was mentioning to some people earlier tonight that I recently viewed Michael Schumann's lecture on going local, and it was a very well-prepared and very insightful presentation. He mentioned local currencies in that, but of course didn't go into any great detail. The importance of a local exchange system, and we sometimes talk about currencies, but it's not only currency. Actually, currency is a word that has a lot of different meanings. You can develop a local currency, or you can develop a mutual credit clearing system. And I'm going to talk mostly about the latter in tonight's presentation. Basically, the fact is this. Money is credit. If there's one big secret about money, that's it. Money is credit. Now, we have all this folklore about gold and silver and redeemability and reserves and all of that stuff. Forget it. Money today is credit. That's all it is. And credit is the lifeblood of business. But there are two distinct credit functions that often get mixed up. You have the exchange function. This is short-term credit or working capital. It's also been called turnover credit. Turnover credit is credit that represents goods that are in the market ready to be sold. So you can think of money as short-term credit. Money is a virtual representation of value that's in the market ready to be sold. So in managing a money system, you want to create money as goods and services go into the market. You don't want to create money that doesn't have attendant goods and services going to market. This is often confused with the finance function. People often ask, what about savings? What about if you want to save something up for a big purchase? Or what if you want to finance the creation of a new business? Well, that's the finance function. The finance function involves long-term investment. And savings and investment are two sides of the same coin. If I have surplus money in today's system, what do I do with it? I don't leave it in my checking account. I invest it. If I want to save, I put it into a different medium. So I'm going to be strict in applying these terminologies. Money is short-term credit. If you want savings and investment, that's long-term credit. So credit comes from the word credo, which means belief. And so the question is, what do we believe? What's credit based on? It's based on trust. So who do you trust? Who are you willing to trust? Are you yourself trustworthy? It's all promises. Every piece of currency, every demand deposit, every savings deposit, every CD, every stock, every bond is a claim. That's all it is. It's a claim. It's a legal claim against something. So it's all based on promises. Now, some of these promises are more secure than others. Some have very strict legal contracts attending them. Others have collateral assets that can be foreclosed and liquidated in case of default. I have a slideshow on my website called The Evolution of Money, and I'm just going to give you the overview. Historically, money was commodities. Various things have served as money. Tobacco, hides, gold and silver are the best known. And when people wanted to buy something, actually they just turned over a piece of gold or a piece of silver. But that's basically still a barter transaction. It's one commodity for another. Then later on, the advantages of symbolic money became apparent. So banks began to issue paper currency that were redeemable for commodity money. So you could take your bank note and pass it across the counter and say, give me the gold. And then, when gold and silver weren't sufficient to provide the exchange media needed by developing economies, bankers invented credit money. Credit money is perfectly legitimate money if it's properly issued. It's really something that's backed up by physical assets. But instead of gold and silver on deposit, credit money would be backed up by, say, a mortgage note or a bill of sale on inventory. But the thing is, credit money is usually based on long-term assets. There's a monetary doctrine called the real bills doctrine. If I sell you some merchandise, I send you an invoice and I ship the goods, but you have a certain length of time to pay me. So there might be 30 days or 60 days elapsed before you receive the goods and before you have to make payment. So that's a real bill. When I send you an invoice, that's called a real bill. And one of the primary sources of credit money in the early days of banking was when banks would take those bills and create money on the basis of those bills. Now, what are the sources of credit for business? Well, the first thing we think about, of course, is banks. You go to the bank and you get a loan. But that's not the only source of credit. You can also get credit from your customers. Gift cards are becoming more and more popular. I usually get a couple of them at Christmas time. My kids know that I like books, so they send me a gift card from Barnes & Noble or Borders. Basically, what that amounts to is pre-sold goods. It's prepayment for merchandise that hasn't been delivered yet. Still another source of credit for a business is suppliers and employees. So suppliers might be paid with vouchers or merchandise certificates or complementary currencies. Likewise, you might pay your employees partly in merchandise certificates or vouchers. This was quite common in mining towns in the old days. Of course, it led to a lot of abuse sometimes, with the company store being the only place where you could spend the vouchers. And quite often the prices were elevated above what they normally would have been. But this can be a legitimate source of credit for a business if it's done correctly with vouchers or direct credit clearing, which we'll get into in a minute. I'm talking these days about the credit commons. It's one aspect of the commons that has been forgotten and abused. Privatization of the commons has been rampant in all aspects, and I think what we need to do is to begin to restore the commons, including the credit commons. The organization and allocation of credit is a fundamental feature of civilized society, and so it's crucial how we manage to do that. Now, currently, we allow the banking system, and banking is actually mainly a cartel. We allow the banking system to control the credit commons and to control access to credit. So the only way that we can get access to the credit commons now is by going through a bank, and banks allocate credit by making what they call loans. So either an individual or the government or business would have to go through a bank to access the credit commons. Access to credit being controlled by the banking system means that banks get to decide who gets credit and on what terms. Of course, banks collect interest whenever they make a loan, so credit becomes expensive. Favored clients get credit on easy terms, while others go begging. That's the whole basis for the micro-lending movement. Many people were denied access to credit until Muhammad Yunus started the Grameen Bank, and that was replicated by FINCA and many other organizations. So micro-lending is big business now, but it still involves lending at interest. National governments especially have extraordinary access to credit because they have sort of a collusive arrangement with the banking system that allows the governments to spend as much as they want without regard to tax revenues. How is it that the United States government can run budget deficits of $400 billion, $500 billion a year, year after year after year? It's because they have special access to the credit commons through the banking system. So they can borrow as much as they want, mainly to fight wars, and never have to repay it. When was the last time the U.S. government paid anything back on national debt? Yeah, there were a couple modest surpluses during the Clinton administration. Didn't last long. So the point is that direct access to credit is possible and desirable, and it's crucial to our efforts at relocalization. It's our collective credit that supports the monetary system, and we have the power to use our credit as we wish. We're free to decide who we will trust, and we can allocate credit directly to one another. Now, how are we going to do this? You know, this sounds complicated. Well, it really isn't that complicated, and I'll explain. Let me compare the conventional payment process using bank credit with an alternative. Let's suppose we have these four companies. Let's suppose that Alpha owes Bravo $100. Bravo owes Charlie $100. Charlie owes Delta $100. Delta owes Alpha $100. How do these debts get discharged? Well, typically, at least one of these companies has to go to a bank and borrow some money into circulation. So let's say it's Alpha that goes and borrows $100 from the bank. Then it pays Bravo. Now Bravo has $100. It can pay what it owes to Charlie. And Charlie can now pay what it owes to Delta, and Delta can pay what it owes to Alpha. Now everybody's been paid, except the bank, but Alpha now has the $100 back, so it can repay what it owes to the bank. However, there's also interest due on that loan. Now, one of the destabilizing and dysfunctional aspects of the dominant money and banking system is the fact that when the bank makes a loan, it creates the principal, but it doesn't create the money to pay the interest. So you have this exponential growth in debt with the passage of time. That's what the compound interest formula is. It's exponential. It's that upward sloping curve that accelerates in its growth. And that's what's destroying the planet. That's what's destroying the social fabric in the world. And that's what's driving us to extinction if we continue. What's the alternative? Well, here we have the same four companies, the same four debts. Alpha owes 100 to Bravo. Bravo owes 100 to Charlie. Charlie owes 100 to Delta, and Delta owes 100 to Alpha. Well, suppose Bravo is willing to accept Alpha's IOU. That is, give Alpha credit. So it accepts Alpha's IOU as payment. And let's suppose Charlie is willing to accept that IOU in turn as payment from Bravo, and Delta is willing to accept it in payment from Charlie. And finally, Delta pays Alpha the $100 that it owes Alpha. So Alpha started this process by issuing an IOU, and it ended the process by redeeming its own IOU. So again, everybody's been paid using the internal credit of Alpha. All the debts have been paid and no interest was required. So this is the basic idea behind mutual credit clearing. Now, in this particular example, we're talking about the credit of only one company, Alpha. But in a well-organized mutual credit system, we're talking about the collective credit of all the members. And we'll get to that in a minute. So to explain further, what is a mutual credit clearing exchange? It's an association of buyers and sellers that provides for the direct settlement of bills due to one another without the use of conventional money or banks. This reduces or diminishes the need for conventional money as an intermediary payment medium. So this association of traders can agree to offset purchases against sales among one another. In effect, goods and services pay for other goods and services. That's true no matter what. We only use money as an intermediary device to facilitate this process. And we're so accustomed to doing that, we never think that there might be another possibility. So another way to describe this is that accounts receivable are used to offset accounts payable. Every business has accounts receivable and accounts payable. An account receivable results when you ship goods to a customer and you give them an invoice and you wait for payment. An account payable is when you receive goods from a supplier and they wait for you to pay them. And usually there's some time period, depending on the line of business. It might be 30 days or 60 days or in some cases even 90 days before you have to settle your bill. So that time span and that giving of credit to one another provides the space for everything to work out. So goods and services pay for other goods and services. Money is an intermediary device. When you sell something in a credit clearing system, your account gets credited. That means increased. When you buy something, your account gets debited, decreases. So you have an account balance. Sometimes your balance is positive. You've sold more than you've bought. Sometimes your account balance is negative when you've bought more than you've sold. But these are temporary conditions. in the long run, your account balance is going to fluctuate around zero. Now, people often ask, well, what happens at the end of the cycle, at the end of the month, or at the end of the two-month period, if there are residual balances? Some people are going to be in the negative, some are going to be in the positive. Well, if it really bothers you to have that situation, you can settle up. It's like you do at the end of a poker game, you know? Those who have more chips than they started with get cash, and those who have fewer chips pay in cash. But the amount of cash needed to settle is very small in comparison to the total amount of business transacted. But ideally, in a mutual credit clearing system, we would carry those balances over indefinitely. Here's an example. Talking about community support dollars, suppose we have this mutual credit clearing system, and we've issued 100,000 credits within the system. That means that the collective cash expenditures of the associated businesses are reduced by $100,000. And that $100,000 remains within the circle to be spent within the circle and not for imports from outside. Now, if the turnover of that credit is 10 times a year, that $100,000 in credit is going to finance the exchange of $1 million of local sales. And if the profit on those sales is only 20%, that means additional yearly profits of $200,000 for the associated members. Further, if the issuance of CSDs will enable some interest-bearing debt to be retired, it's $100,000 worth of working capital that you don't have to borrow from a bank. And if you're paying 10% interest on short-term debt to the bank, that means $10,000 of saved interest each year. So to sum up, every dollar's worth of community support dollar credits that are issued means one less dollar that needs to be borrowed, one less dollar that needs to be spent, and one less dollar that needs to be repaid at interest. Now, is this just a pipe dream? Not at all. We have precedents and we have examples, one of which is the Swiss Vierbank that was started in 1934 in the midst of the Great Depression. The Vierbank is a mutual credit clearing system operated for the benefit of the small and medium-sized businesses throughout Switzerland. Now, this credit clearing circle has thrived for more than 70 years. It has now 60,000 business members throughout Switzerland. It has 6 regional offices, and in 2004, it cleared the equivalent of $1.35 billion worth of credits. That's the amount of sales that went through this mutual credit clearing circle. Now, in 2005, I visited the Vierbank, and I also had the occasion to speak with a professor, Tobias Studer. And Tobias Studer is on their board of advisors, and he wrote a book about the history and the operations of the Vierbank. And your own Phil Beard translated that book from German into English, and it's a very important book to read. It's available on the web through lulu.com. You can download it for $3, is it? Or you can get a hard copy for something like $15. Now,
L-U-L-U.
L-U-L-U, yeah. It's
name
not.
The book? It's called The Beer and the Swiss National Economy. Beer and the Swiss National Economy.
I will give you a reference website at the end of the presentation through which that is linked. You'll find it on my website. So this is one example of a successful mutual credit clearing operation. Unfortunately, it hasn't been replicated widely. The Swiss are very coy about this, and, I won't go into that.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Maybe later in the Q&A. This is a graphical representation of a mutual credit clearing system. Let's suppose the oval defines the boundaries of our association. And the little smiley faces represent the businesses who are members of the association. Now, you note I have two different classes of membership. The greenies are members who can issue credit, and the others are non-issuing members. What I mean by that is an issuer is one that has a line of credit that is an overdraft privilege. That's a member that can buy before they sell. Their balance can go negative. They are the source of the credits that will circulate within the association. The non-issuing members must earn before they can spend. They must sell before they buy. So the issuing members begin this process by buying from other members. So the arrows represent the expenditure of credits. And it started with this issuing member buying something from that member and using credits to pay for it. So those credits will circulate internally pretty much indefinitely. Now, is this an elitist approach to exchange? Well, not really. This can benefit the entire community, but you have to determine who is qualified to issue credits that will circulate within the association and outside of the association. Here's our mutual credit clearing system again. Let's suppose that one of the members of the clearing association wants to buy something from a non-member, someone outside of the association, but still in the community. Those non-member users will be represented by these gray smiley faces. They're not members, but they're in the community, and they have goods and services to offer. Well, you can externalize the credit that exists in a mutual credit clearing association, either by printing notes to represent the credit, or by using smart cards or stored value cards. It's easiest to think in terms of notes. So this process begins when this member bought something from this non-member, and this non-member agreed to accept the association credits as payment. And this is strictly voluntary. There's no legal tender laws supporting this currency. It has to stand on its own merits, and people can refuse it or they can discount it if they want. So note that those credits have to eventually come back inside the oval. They need to be redeemed by someone in the association because it's the collective credit of the association members that stands behind these currency notes. So let's review the advantages of this local circulation. Currency credits that are created in this way must return to the issuers for redemption. And we're not talking about redemption in gold or silver or even Federal Reserve notes. We're talking about redemption in valuable goods and services, which are the stock in trade of the members that issued the credits to begin with. So for this reason, the credits are captive within the local economy. They're not going to go very far for very long because they have to come back for redemption. And their recirculation within the local area provides a built-in buy local bias. If I have local currency credits in my hand instead of dollars, I'm going to favor the local merchants who accept those local credits. So they give local sources of supply a preference over external sources. Decentralized exchange and payment options, such as we've described, provide enhanced local autonomy. If we have our own medium of exchange, we're going to be less subject to the influence of the Federal Reserve, whether they decide to make money easy or tight, whether they decide to make interest rates high or low, whether the government decides to run a big deficit or a small one. It gives greater local economic health and security because now we have a more abundant supply of exchange media. You know, the supply of dollars is always scarce. It provides a counterweight against systematic monetary instability. It provides a recovery path in case of financial collapse, and more people are expressing concern about that because of the twin deficits, the budget deficit and the trade deficit. And it ultimately results in greater equity, social harmony, and local quality of life. Well, how do we go about implementing something like this? Well, you do it in stages. The first stage is to organize the Mutual Credit Clearing Circle comprised of trusted business issuers. You want to get the most popular, most financially sound businesses in your community to be the initial issuing members. And if you can get the local government involved, that's a bonus. So you start with trusted issuers, and they can begin to trade among themselves using internal credits. Then they can collectively issue a currency that will circulate throughout the entire local economy. And people will be willing to accept that currency because they know they can take it back to the trusted issuers for valuable goods and services that they want and use every day. If you get the power company involved, for example, if you have a local power company, or if you have the local food co-op, or a restaurant, popular restaurant like this, try to get the most popular trusted businesses to be the anchor, the foundation businesses in this system. It's like when they develop a shopping mall. You know, they first start out by recruiting the anchor stores, the JCPenney's, the Robinson Mays, Dillard's, Home Depot, you know, the big ones that are going to by themselves attract customers to the plaza. So second stage is to accept to membership diverse other participants, but don't give them overdraft privileges to begin with. Require that they earn before they spend. Then in the third stage, you can invite non-member local merchants to be currency users. They would be the gray circles that we saw in the diagram. Invite them to accept the local currency. The advantage to them will be that they will attract more business to their stores compared to stores that don't accept the local currency. Because as the currency becomes widespread and dispersed throughout the community, those businesses that accept it in payment are going to attract more of the business. So now you've got everybody in the community, or almost everybody, using the currency. So when the credit clearing circle is functioning smoothly and the currency has been widely accepted, then you can ease the restrictions on membership and bring more and more people, more and more businesses into it. But whether you give overdraft privileges or not depends on the sales history and the credit worthiness of each new member. And people often ask, what do you use to determine the credit limits? Well, there's a good rule of thumb that has been developed over the past from experience, and it says that the amount of turnover credits, or the amount of short-term credits that we use as money, should not exceed 3 months' sales. So if a business has $50,000 sales a month, you could safely allow them to overdraw by $150,000. But I wouldn't go anywhere near that limit to begin with. I think to begin with, you could get by with maybe a third of that. Another point is that you have to operate this as a self-sustaining business. One of the problems with local currency systems and mutual credit systems that have been implemented in this country and in other countries is that they've been volunteer-based. People don't get paid for their work, so you end up with volunteer burnout. People get tired of doing the work. The system is not operated in a business-like fashion, and eventually it just falls apart. So this has to be operated according to sound business principles. You have to charge fees that are going to cover the costs. But, you know, the larger this exchange system becomes, the smaller those fees can be. you've got to reach critical mass where you can provide the service at a competitive fee. Businesses pay a transaction fee on credit card transactions. I think it's anywhere from 3 to 5% on average. Well, some people have estimated, and I tend to agree, that once we get a mutual credit clearing system of sufficient scale, we can operate it efficiently with transaction fees of less than 1%. And some of those expenses are cash expenses, so you also have to have some cash income. Some of the expenses can be paid using internal credits, like maybe the employees could take a portion of their salary in internal credits and a portion in conventional money. But all salaries need to be paid out of revenues generated from service fees, not from borrowing. This last point highlights one of the deficiencies in the commercial trade exchanges. You're probably familiar with BXI, barter card, ITEX, business-to-business trade exchanges that do things like this already. The commercial barter industry, and barter is a misnomer here, they're really credit clearing exchanges, has been around for more than 30 years, and there are many very successful companies that are providing this service for businesses to trade with one another. And they pay large fees for the service. But a lot of those systems give themselves extraordinary privilege to borrow on their own account. So they end up running up a big system debt, which eventually debases the value of the credits in their system. So they put themselves into competition with the members and create a conflict of interest. So system account deficits should be avoided or strictly limited. So basically, that's the presentation. Here are some resources that you can avail yourself of. The first is reinventingmoney.com. That's a website that I initiated about 4 years ago. It's recently been redesigned and reorganized, and you'll find links to lots of valuable information about this exchange process and about creating currency systems. I have a blog called Beyond Money that's on WordPress that provides more up-to-the-minute information about things that you might find useful, what I'm doing, where I'm going. The last two items are references to my books. This is the most recent one, which was published by Chelsea Green in 2001. This was the first one that I published back in 1990, called Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis. It's basically an analysis and critique of the dominant monetary system with, in the latter part, some guidance as to how a better system might be created. New Money for Healthy Communities was in between those two, and it was basically an overview of alternative exchange systems. It's been pretty much superseded by the money book. I also want to call your attention to this book and this one. These are both by E.C. Riegel. I learned more from Riegel than from anybody else. He died in 1954, but he's tremendously insightful about how money works, what money is, and I highly recommend those to you.